This is Abundance. I am your host, Dane Allred. Today we'll look at reform number 765 from my list of 1,001 thanks. I know I need to reform, and so might you. Let's spend this next hour trying to figure out the kind of changes we need. Reform is part of the abundance I celebrate. Our episodes today include The Reformation, Change a Man, A New Path, and Wonderful Changes. And you'll hear another O. Henry story called The Cop and the Anthem, and the poem Gunga Din by Rudyard Kipling. That's today on Abundance. A funny thing happened on the way to Dane Allred. The Reformation. Mark Twain once said, "Nothing so needs reforming as other people's habits." One of the great things about a routine is it does predict what will happen during the week. Working is a great way to get into the habit of doing some of the same things every day. Get to work, get going, go to lunch, finish up, go home. We even end up doing some of the same things every night. Changing what we do is often very hard. Once we are in the grips of habit, it's very hard not to stop and have the giant soda every morning. We get to know the people at the store, get used to the drive, and find ourselves in the same place every day. When I was a junior in high school, I used to have the same lunch every day, even though it wasn't very healthy. If you've had a Suzy Q, a delicious Hostess product, you know the whipped cream center surrounded by devil's food cake is probably not the best daily lunch. Chase that sugary goodness with a little Fanta orange soda, and you have the preferred lunch of my 11th grade year. I could even see myself sitting on the steps of the old Jordan High School at about the same time every day. Routine is good for us if we want to earn a living. When we're working for others, showing up on time and leaving at the appropriate time are considered good behaviors. Completing our work is usually a good indication we'll keep the job. And routine can help us get things done. I find I get the most done early in the morning, but that might be because my job allows time to prepare in the morning. I do most of my teaching later in the morning and in the afternoon. I also teach some evenings, so if I get prepared for the day early, most of the rest of the day goes well. I hate when I don't have time to get ready, and luckily, that happens less and less the longer I work. But it doesn't take much to upset a schedule. There could be an accident delaying traffic on the way to work, or there could be extra errands. With recent construction on our roads, I've had some interesting delays. One of the changes was a left turn to go south onto the freeway. The light was adjusted to let the freeway traffic have the right of way most of the time, since that was the only freeway entrance into our fair city. So every morning for a year, almost without fail, I got to wait about a minute and a half at that light, waiting to go south. I reformed my ways and decided to use the time better. Instead of getting impatient and wondering why I had to sit and wait, I decided to use the time to clean the garbage, which is always accumulating in my car. Now that the road is finished, I almost miss the chance every day to clean the car. Going to work a different way has also helped me save a little time now, so I can use those extra minutes to be better prepared for the day. Sometimes we have to reform our ways because we want to keep living. When the doctor tells me to stop using so much salt, I guess I better listen if I want to stay around. When I'm told to stop eating broccoli and spinach, I guess I can stop that too. I really do like broccoli and spinach, but I don't want any more kidney stones. I'll bet I probably will get another kidney stone, but it won't be from the oxalates in those vegetables. Some reform is fun. Deciding to do something new because we want to is a good reward for all the other stuff we may have to do we don't like. During the year, I've learned some new things about the computer and about a few computer programs. That's been fun for me because it isn't what I do every day. But if you are a computer entry person and have to be on the computer every day, you probably wouldn't like it. I've learned to do some things I didn't know I would need to know. In the past 10 years, I've learned to blog, podcast, and text. I've learned to use a computer in ways I never imagined. I guess it hasn't hurt me any, but it does make me wonder what kind of things I'll have to learn next. I hope it's easier than texting. I'm still pretty bad at that. Let's just hope it's not too technical or complicated. I just hope I understand it. Listening to Abundance. This is Dane Allred. Today we're talking about reform. Funny thing happened on the way to Dane Allred. Change a man. There's an old joke about not trying to change a man unless he is in diapers. Reforming ourselves may be just as difficult, especially if the change involves food. I complained last week about not getting my au jus with my French dip sandwich, and I guess it has been bothering me so much I got another one this week. But before I pulled out of the Arby's parking lot, I checked to see if I had my hot, meaty au jus, and it was there, and the sandwich was delicious. So eating habits can be hard to change, and I have found the fewer things I'm actually allowed to eat, the more weight I gain. I was okay with cutting out broccoli and spinach, but it has to be replaced by something, and that day, it was curly fries. At least they're in the vegetable group. The fried vegetable group, but at least at one point, they were vegetables. I had the same problem with soda, or you may call it pop. As a dedicated Coca-Cola drinker for the first 21 years of my life, I had a problem when we moved to California. The water at the Coke bottling plant was nasty, and I could taste it in the drink. I switched to Pepsi, and I've never gone back, and now I've been drinking Pepsi longer than I ever drank Coke, by about 10 years. I've teased my mother before about weaning me with Num Num, one of my first words for the nectar of the gods we call cola, but there always was a bottle around, and I got used to having caffeine whenever I wanted it. For those of you who are caffeine purists, I do have to state for the record that caffeine is my drug of choice. I even like it when it comes to my pain medication, and probably so do you. No, you scoff. Well, contemplate this little detail. If you like Excedrin as your drug of choice to get rid of the headaches, pains, and other life complaints, you may be one of my caffeinated friends. Each tablet contains 65 milligrams of caffeine along with the other ingredients. That's the same amount of caffeine in 4 12-ounce Cokes or 3 12-ounce Pepsis. No wonder I like Pepsi better. More caffeine per cup. Thinking about the relative ease of my access to caffeine in my youth makes me wonder what restrictions on goodies does to us. I know my wife has a great sweet tooth, and her parents worked on the principle of the equally divided candy bar. Since she was in a larger family, they didn't buy each kid a candy bar, but split up the delicious treat equally so each kid would get about a fifth each. When we married, I was used to eating a whole candy bar, and she wasn't. When I told her to pick her own candy bar, she kept insisting on having part of mine, and I don't like to share all that much. She told me recently, after more than 30 years of marriage, that she thought I was incredibly wasteful and greedy to want to eat a whole candy bar myself instead of sharing one. She's over that now and doesn't hesitate to get whatever she wants. But I bet it still makes her feel guilty. Here's one food reform which has worked for me. Since I'm basically a lazy person, I have found a couple of foods I like to eat for breakfast and lunch. I keep them both at work and use the microwave I brought from home to prepare these incredibly bland, boring, and mostly tasteless meals. I cook oatmeal for a couple of minutes each morning and dump a bit of real maple syrup on it. Then I start cooking some brown rice for lunch, and I've only burned the rice 4 or 5 times of the hundreds of times I've prepared it. That's right, I eat rice for lunch every day and oatmeal for breakfast every day. It's probably more healthy than the stuff I used to eat, which was mostly prepackaged. It is bland and it is boring, and people ask me how I can stand to eat the same thing every day. I'm not sure how to answer. I like to drink Pepsi every day, and no one asks me why I drink the same drink all the time. They know I'm addicted, and they know better than to ask. But can you get addicted to oatmeal, maple syrup, rice, and sugar? Probably. At least my body knows what it's going to get most days. I guess the process of reformation starts with the recognition change is needed and then the willingness to change. Maybe tomorrow I'll have rice for breakfast and oatmeal for lunch. Listening to Abundance. This is Dane Allred. I am your host, and we're today talking about reform number 765 on my list of 1,001 thanks. If you're interested in hearing these podcasts again, these programs are saved in 2 or 3 different places and are now available on iTunes. We've even recently added listeners in Australia, and I'm thankful for all of the international listeners who click onto podbean.com. And if you want to get right to my site, it's daneallred.podbean.com. These blogs are also available with the podcast at 1001thanks.blogspot.com. And you're welcome to tune in anytime and listen to any of those programs. You can even sign up at iTunes to have them automatically loaded to your iPod player. This is Abundance, and it's 20 past the hour. Next up, you'll be hearing O. Henry's Cop in the Anthem and Your Good Man Gunga Din. Literature Out Loud. The Cop and the Anthem by O. Henry. On his bench in Madison Square, Soapy moved uneasily. When wild geese honked high of nights, on his bench in Madison Square, Soapy moved uneasily. When wild geese honk high of nights, and when women without seal coat skins, coats grow kind to their husbands, and when Soapy moves uneasily on his bench in the park, you may know that winter is near at hand. A dead leaf fell in Soapy's lap. That was Jack Frost's card. Jack is kind to the regular denizens of Madison Square and gives fair warning of his annual call. At the corners of four streets, he hands his pasteboard to the North Wind, footmen of the mansion of all outdoors, so that the inhabitants thereof may make ready. Soapy's mind became cognizant of the fact that the time had come for him to resolve himself into a singular committee of ways and means to provide against the coming rigor. And therefore, he moved uneasily on his bench. The hibernatorial ambitions of Soapy were not of the highest. In them there were no considerations of Mediterranean cruises, of soporific southern skies drifting on the Vesuvian Bay. 3 months on the island was what his soul craved. 3 months of assured board and bed and congenial company, safe from Boreas and Bluecoats, seemed to Soapy the essence of things desirable. For years, the hospitable Blackwells had been his winter quarters. Oh, just as his more fortunate fellow New Yorkers had bought their tickets to Palm Beach and the Riviera each winter, so Soapy had made his humble arrangements for his annual hygiera to the island. And now the time was come. On the previous night, three Sabbath newspapers distributed beneath his coat, about his ankles and over his lap, had failed to repulse the cold as he slept on his bench near the spurting fountain in the ancient square. So the island loomed big and timely in Soapy's mind. He scorned the provisions made in the name of charity for the city's dependents. In Soapy's opinion, the law was more benign than philanthropy. There was an endless round of institutions, municipal and eleemosynary, on which he might set out and receive lodging and food accordant with the simple life. But to one of Soapy's proud spirit, the gifts of charity are encumbered. If not in coin, you must pay in humiliation of spirit for every benefit received at the hands of philanthropy. As Caesar had his Brutus, every bed of charity must have its toll of a bath. Every loaf of bread its compensation of a private and personal inquisition. Wherefore, it is better to be a guest of the law, which, though conducted by rules, does not meddle unduly with a gentleman's private affairs. Soapy, having decided to go to the island, at once set about accomplishing his desire. There were many easy ways of doing this. The pleasantest was to dine luxuriously at some expensive restaurant and then, after declaring insolvency, be handed over quietly and without uproar to a policeman. An accommodating magistrate would do the rest. Soapy left his bench and strolled out of the square and across the level sea of asphalt where Broadway and Fifth Avenue flow together. Up Broadway he turned and halted at a glittering cafe where are gathered together nightly the choicest products of the grape, the silkworm, and the protoplasm. Soapy had confidence in himself from the lowest button of his vest upward. He was shaven, and his coat was decent, and his neat black ready tied four in hand had been presented to him by a lady missionary on Thanksgiving Day. If he could reach a table in the restaurant unsuspected, success would be his. The portion of him that would show above the table would raise no doubt in the waiter's mind. A roasted mallard duck, thought Soapy, would be about the thing. With a bottle of Chablis and then Camembert, a demi-tasse, and a cigar. $1 for the cigar would be enough. The total would not be so high as to call forth any supreme manifestation of revenge from the cafe management, and yet the meat would leave him filled and happy for the journey to his winter refuge. But as Soapy set foot inside the restaurant door, the head waiter's eye fell upon his frayed trousers and decadent shoes. Strong and ready hands turned him about and conveyed him in silence and haste to the sidewalk, and he averted the ignoble fate of the menaced mallard. Soapy turned off Broadway. It seemed that his route to the coveted island was not to be an Epicurean one. Some other way of entering limbo must be thought of. At the corner of 6th Avenue, electric lights and cunningly displayed wares behind a plate glass made a shop window conspicuous. Soapy took a cobblestone and dashed it through the glass. People came running around the corner, a policeman in the lead. Soapy stood still with his hands in his pockets and smiled at the sight of brass buttons. "Where's the man that's done that?" inquired the officer excitedly. "Well, don't you figure that out that I might have something to do with it?" said Soapy, not with sarcasm, but friendly, as one greets good fortune. The policeman's mind refused to accept Soapy even as a clue. Men who smash windows do not remain to parley with the law's minions. They take to their heels. The policeman saw a man halfway down the block running to catch a car. With drawn club, he joined in the pursuit. Soapy, with disgust in his heart, loafed along. Twice unsuccessful. On the opposite side of the street was a restaurant of no great pretensions. It catered to large appetites and modest purses. Its crockery and atmosphere were thick, its soup and napery thin. Into this place, Soapy took his accusative shoes and telltale trousers without challenge. At table, he sat and consumed beefsteak, flapjacks, donuts, and pie. And then to the waiter, he betrayed the fact that the minutest coin and himself were strangers. "Now get busy and call a cop," said Soapy, "and don't keep a gentleman waiting." "No cop for use," said the waiter, with a voice like butter cakes and an eye like the cherry in a Manhattan cocktail. "Hey, can!" Neatly upon his left ear, on the callous pavement, two waiters pitched Soapy. He arose, joint by joint, as a carpenter's rule opens, and beat the dust from his clothes. A rest seemed but a rosy dream. The island seemed very far away. A policeman who stood before a drugstore two doors away laughed and walked down the street. 5 blocks Soapy traveled before his courage permitted him to woo capture again. This time, the opportunity presented what he fatuously termed to himself a cinch. A young woman of a modest and pleasing guise was standing before a show window, gazing with sprightly interest at its display of shaving mugs and inkstands, and 2 yards from the window, a large policeman of severe demeanor leaned against the water plug. It was Soapy's design to assume the role of the despicable and execrated masher. The refined and elegant appearance of his victim and the contiguity of the conscientious cop encouraged him to believe that he would soon feel the pleasant official clutch upon his arm that would ensure his winter quarters on the right little tight little island. Soapy straightened the lady missionary's ready-made tie, dragged his shrinking cuffs into the open, set his hat at a killing cant, and sidled toward the young woman. He made eyes at her, was taken with sudden coughs and hems, smiled, smirked, and went brazenly through the impudent and contemptible litany of the masher. With half an eye, Soapy saw that the policeman was watching him fixedly. The young woman moved away a few steps and again bestowed her absorbed attention upon the shaving mugs. Soapy followed, boldly stepping to her side, raised his hat, and said, "Ah, there, Bedelia, don't you want to come and play in my yard?" The policeman was still looking. The persecuted young woman had but to beckon a finger, and Soapy would be practically en route for his insular haven. Already he imagined he could feel the cozy warmth of the station house. The young woman faced him and, stretching out a hand, caught Soapy's coat sleeve. "Sure, Mike," she said joyfully, "if you'll blow me to a pail of suds. I'd have spoke to you sooner, but the cop was watching." With the young woman playing the clinging ivy to his oak, Soapy walked past the policeman, overcome with gloom. He seemed doomed to liberty. At the next corner, he shook off his companion and ran. He halted in the district where, by night, are found the lightest streets, hearts, vows, and librettos. Women in furs and men in greatcoats moved gaily in the wintry air. A sudden fear seized Soapy that some dreadful enchantment had rendered him immune to arrest. The thought brought a little of panic upon it, and when he came upon another policeman lounging grandly in front of a transplendent theater, he caught at the immediate straw of disorderly conduct. On the sidewalk, Soapy began to yell drunken gibberish at the top of his harsh voice. He danced, howled, raved, and otherwise disturbed the welkin. The policeman twirled his club, turned his back to Soapy, and remarked to a citizen, "'Tis one of them yell lads celebrating the goose egg they gave to Hartford College. Noisy, but no harm. We've instructions to leave him be.' disconsolate, Soapy ceased his unavailing racket. Would never a policeman lay hands on him? In his fancy, the island seemed an unattainable Arcadia. He buttoned his thin coat against the chilling wind. In a cigar store, he saw a well-dressed gentleman lighting a cigar at the swinging light. His silk umbrella he had set by the door on entering. Soapy stepped inside, secured the umbrella, and sauntered off with it slowly. The man at the cigar light followed haste. "My umbrella," he said sternly. "Oh, is it?" sneered Soapy, adding insult to petty larceny. "Well, why don't you call a policeman? I took it, your umbrella. Why don't you call a cop? There stands one on the corner." The umbrella owner slowed his steps. Soapy did likewise, with the presentiment that luck would again run against him. The policeman looked at the two curiously. "Of course," said the umbrella man, "that is, well, you know how these mistakes occur. If it's your umbrella, I hope you'll excuse me. I picked it up this morning in a restaurant. If you recognize it as yours, why, I hope you'll..." "Of course it's mine," said Soapy viciously. The ex-umbrella man retreated. The policeman hurried to assist a tall blonde in an opera cloak across the street in front of a streetcar that was approaching two blocks away. Soapy walked eastward through a street damaged by improvements. He hurled the umbrella wrathfully into an excavation. He muttered against the men who wear helmets and carry clubs because he wanted to fall into their clutches. They seemed to regard him as a king who could do no wrong. At length, Soapy reached one of the avenues to the east where the glitter and turmoil was but faint. He set his face down toward Madison Square, for the homing instinct survives even when the home is a park bench. But on an unusually quiet corner, Soapy came to a standstill. Here was an old church, quaint and rambling and gabled, where for the homing instinct survives even when the home is a park bench. But on an unusually quiet corner, Soapy came to a standstill. Here was an old church, quaint and rambling and gabled. Through one violet-stained window, a soft light glowed where, no doubt, the organist loitered over the keys, making sure of his mastery of the coming Sabbath anthem. For there drifted out to Soapy's ears sweet music that caught and held him transfixed against the convolutions of the iron fence. The moon was above, lustrous and serene. Vehicles and pedestrians were few. Sparrows twittered sleepily in the eaves. For a little while, the scene might have been a country churchyard, and the anthem that the organist played cemented Soapy to the iron fence, for he had known it well in the days when his life contained such things as mothers and roses and ambitions and friends and immaculate thoughts and collars. The conjunction of Soapy's receptive state of mind and the influence about the old church wrought a sudden and wonderful change in his soul. He viewed with swift horror the pit into which he had tumbled, the degraded days, unworthy desires, dead hopes, wrecked faculties, and base motives that had made up his existence. And also, in a moment, his heart responded thrillingly to this novel mood. An instantaneous and strong impulse moved him to battle with his desperate fate. He would pull himself out of the mire. He would make a man of himself again. He would conquer the evil that had taken possession of him. There was time. He was comparatively young yet. He would resurrect his old, eager ambitions and pursue them without faltering. Those solemn but sweet organ notes had set up a revolution in him. Tomorrow, he would go into the roaring downtown district and find work. A fur importer had once offered him a place as a driver. He would find him tomorrow and ask for the position. He would be somebody in the world. He would... Soapy felt a hand laid on his arm. He looked around quickly into the broad face of a policeman. "What are you doing here?" asked the police officer. "Nothing," said Soapy. "Then come along," said the policeman. 3 months on the island, said the magistrate in the police court the next morning. Literature Out Loud, Gunga Din, a poem by Rudyard Kipling. Gunga Din. You may talk of gin and beer when you're quartered safe out here and you're sent to penny fights in Aldershot. But when it comes to slaughter, you will do your work on water, and you'll lick the bloomin' boots of him that's got it. Now in India's sunny clime, where I used to spend me time, a servant of Her Majesty the Queen, of all them black-faced crew, the finest man I knew was our regimental beastie, Gunga Din. He was, "Din, din, din, you limpin' lump of brick dust, Gunga Din, high slippery hither-ay-o, water, get it, panny-lay-o, you squidgy-nose old idol, Gunga Din." The uniform he wore was nothing much before, and rather less than half of that behind, for a piece of twisty rag and a goat-skin water-bag was all the field equipment he could find. When the sweatin' troop lay trainin' a sidin' through the day, where the eat would make your bloomin' eyebrows crawl, we shouted, "Harry, bye," till our throats were bricky dry, and we whopped him 'cause he couldn't serve us all. It was, "Din, din, din, you heathen, where the mischief have you been? You put some joldy in it, or I'll marrow you this minute if you don't fill up my helmet, Gunga Din." He would dot and carry one till the longest day was done, and he didn't seem to know the use of fear. If we charged or broke a cut, you could bet your bloomin' nut he'd be waiting 50 paces, right flank rear. With his mussick on his back, he would skip with our attack and watch us till the bugles made retire. And for all his dirty-eyed, he was white, clear white inside, when he went to tend the wounded under fire. It was, "Din, din, din," with the bullets kicking dust spots on the green. When the cartridges ran out, you could hear the front files shout, "Hi, ammunition mules, and Gunga Din." I shan't forget the night when I dropped behind the fight with a bullet where my belt plate should have been. I was choking mad with thirst, and the man that spied me first was a good old grinning, grunting Gunga Din. He lifted up me head, and he plugged me where I bled, and he gave me half a pint of water green. It was crawling and it stunk, but of all the drinks I've drunk, I'm gratefulest to one from Gunga Din. It was, "Din, din, din, here's a beggar with a bullet through his spleen. He's chawing up the ground and he's kicking all around. For God's sake, get the water, Gunga Din." He carried me away to where a dooley lay, and a bullet come and drilled the beggar clean. He put me safe inside, and just before he died, "I hope you like your drink," says Gunga Din. So I'll meet him later on at the place where he's gone, where it's always double drill and no canteen. He'll be squatting on the coals, giving drink to poor damned souls, and I'll get a swig in hell from Gunga Din. Yes, "Din, din, din, you Lazarusian leather Gunga Din, though I've belted you and flayed you, by the living God that made you, you're a better man than I am, Gunga Din." You're listening to Abundance Today. We're talking about reform. In just a moment, a new path. A funny thing happened on the way today in Allred. A new path. Habits can dull us to the real question many people ask at some time in their lives. When we stop and think, we ought to consider why we are here. Is there a reason for you to be here on this planet at this particular time? Have you thought about what it is you are here to do? Do you have a higher purpose? Is there a nagging suspicion in the back of your mind telling you there has to be more? Perhaps it is time to explore the unexplored part of ourselves. Henry David Thoreau once said, "When it's time to die, let us not discover that we have never lived." Reforming our lives is not an easy thing. Apparently, I am supposed to attend more wedding receptions, since twice in 2 days, I have been reprimanded by the chaotic forces of my life. Yesterday, one of my former students, again, invited me to attend her wedding reception. On a campus of thousands of people, she and her sister found me in my car and reminded me about the wedding. She even turned to her sister and insisted, "I never attend receptions." It's true. I am a little antisocial when it comes to keeping in touch with former students. I usually have so much to do with my current students that I tend to lose track of the old ones. I also have church responsibilities which would normally include attending an unusually high number of wedding receptions. So let's just say I probably have been avoiding one of my social duties. When we talk of reforming ourselves, going to social functions may not be at the top of the list, but someone or something is trying to get me a message about honoring the norms of our society, and that includes celebrating the fact people want to spend their lives together. People came to my wedding reception. Why am I so stubborn? Some of these social customs are the glue that hold our society together, and with so many distractions in our lives, it is easy to neglect the things that make us a society. While I'm on the subject, I have been reading some of the writings of Eric Hoffer this week, and he believed we join mass movements because of the emptiness we feel in life. In his book, The True Believer, he tried to help us understand why people would support Nazi policies, and he concluded most people would rather be told what to do than use the freedom we have to find out what we really want to do. He also said that when people are left to do as they please, they usually imitate each other. I hope this is an opportunity today for you to really examine your life and see if you're doing something that makes a difference in your life and the lives of others. When we get outside of our prejudices, hatreds, and envies, we are really able to do those things we're meant to do. As Eric Hoffer observed, people hate those who remind them of their inadequacies, of their own shortcomings. We need to examine the causes we so vehemently support and wonder out loud just what the energy could be better spent doing. You know what it is. No one else can tell you what you need to be doing. You know what would be a better use of your time. The real question is whether you're going to get up off the couch and do it. It doesn't have to be a thermonuclear reaction. It may be you just need to attend more wedding receptions and affirm the urge of most in this world to try and make the world a better place for themselves, but also for someone else. We all sacrifice something to exist in this human sphere, and that might be paying more taxes than we want so the roads will be better. It might be getting paid less than we want for a more satisfying job. It may be using our millions to make the lives of others better. There really is something about being excited about our own causes. We don't need the direction of someone else. We don't need marching orders. We don't have to say someone gave us an order we were just following. We'll be focused on what is right and what is wrong, and we'll be very clear about what we can do about it. If what we think we need to do involves tearing down someone else, well, then probably we need to ponder our true purpose some more. There's today's challenge. Can we find out what it is we really want to be doing and not just following somebody else? Good luck. It is harder than it sounds. But do invite me to your wedding reception. Funny thing happened on the way to Dane Allred. Wonderful changes. If we live long enough, we get to see some pretty amazing things. Even though day after day it may seem we are doing the same thing, if we're paying attention, we get to see the good changes as well as the bad. It's interesting to me to think back to the good old days and remember some of them really weren't so good. Sure, gasoline was cheap, but the cars got really bad mileage. I used to work at a gas station when I was a teenager, and they let me charge the gas I used. But the car I drove got such poor mileage, I never really made much money. It's like when my wife worked at a place which doesn't exist anymore. She was a sales clerk at Castleton's, and they let her charge all the clothes she cared to buy. She really didn't make any money either, but she did end up with some nice clothes. The good old days, back when I was working way harder than I seem to work now, were the days of minimum wage, which was a couple of dollars. I think I may have started working when the minimum wage was just under $2, and remember being so excited when it went all the way up to $2.35 an hour. It's funny to think of all the things I wanted back then when I didn't have any money, and how excited I was when I could actually afford something I wanted. Now, I really make much more money per hour, and don't really seem to need to buy anything in particular. This may be because, as parents, we seem to want to spend more on our children than ourselves. When a car breaks down or a deposit and rent is needed for a sudden move, it makes me glad I have some extra cash when it's needed, because my parents and in-laws were there when I needed them. Greatest changes in the world happen as we get older and realize the really special people we have traveling with us on this wonderful journey. There are ups and there are downs, but every day I wake up and see the new and amazing developments, wondering what might be happening tomorrow. It's an exciting time to be alive and wonder what comes next. I might not get my flying car tomorrow, and they may not find a cure for cancer next Wednesday, but the world I live in now has chemotherapy strong enough to kill the cancer that was trying to kill my wife. It's been 15 years that I didn't think I'd get with her. This really is an amazing time to live. We've bought new cars and then driven them until they wouldn't drive anymore, but the cars available today are so much more technologically advanced. They can even keep you in your lane, stop your car if there's trouble, show you where you're backing up, tell you when to turn left or right. I think of all the theories, books, stories, poems we can read and think about today, which were never available any other time in the history of the world. And it makes me amazed to think that Martin Luther struggled so ordinary people could just read the Bible. In a time when the complexities of the world really seem to flood over us like a tidal wave, it's good to remember we are participants in the greatest experiment ever. We get a chance to take part. The future may not turn out the way we want, but if we aren't part of the process, it will continue to change and evolve, perhaps in ways we don't like. What is the change you want to see in the world? Gandhi said, "We must be the change we wish to see in the world." But what is that change? Will you be part of the solution to ending world hunger? Will you find a way to cure those dreaded diseases that still haunt mankind? Will you be the one who leads humanity to be more humane, more caring, more able to make the world better for everyone instead of just a few? The change we see in the future really is in our hands. And one person can be the beginning of a new idea which changes the world as we know it. It may be something simple. It might not shake the foundations of humanity. Maybe you'll invent the next post-it note. Maybe it will be the next sandwich I can't live without. Maybe it will be a way to keep our children safe and our grandparents more healthy. We're just as excited as you to find out what it is. Listening to Abundance. This is Dane Allred. Today we've been talking about reform, number 765 on my list of 1,001 thanks, the 1,001 things I'm thankful for. If you'd like to hear these broadcasts, they are available at my website, daneallred.com. That's daneallred.com. Or just type my name, Dane Allred, into a browser. These podcasts are also available at daneallred.podbean.com and the blog version at 1,001thanks.blogspot.com. You can also get these now on iTunes, downloadable to your iPod at any time, 24/7. I'd like to thank my listeners all over the world, including our new listeners in Australia, Singapore, Africa, Sweden, France, and Belgium.